Welcome back to the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. Sentientism answers those two deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I talk to Marcus Daniel. Marcus is a professional tennis player from New Zealand. He's also a philanthropist and an advocate for effective altruism through his work as a founder of High Impact Athletes. HIA helps athletes pledge donations to the most effective charities working on global poverty, animal welfare, and climate change. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the podcast as a whole, so why not write a review or give us some stars on your listening platform. Every share, review, and rating helps us nudge a few more people towards compassionate, rational thinking. You can find out more about sentientism at sentientism.info, or just search for sentientism on your favorite social media platform. You'll be made very welcome in any of our global community groups. They're open to anyone interested, not just sentientists. Why not follow us on Twitter at sentientism too? Thanks for listening. Hey, Marcus, how are you?
Great, thanks. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, it's great to get a chance to meet you properly. I think you're the first person from the world of sport to join me on this series so far. I've had activists and CEOs and philosophers and academics and actors and songwriters, but you're the first person from the world of sport. So it's great to have the chance to talk to you about these important topics.
It's an honor, and hopefully I'm the first of many. Hopefully we can sway more people towards this way of thinking, and you'll have a flood of athletes after me.
Sounds good to me. You can help me with some introductions. As we've talked about briefly before, I guess this series of conversations are about what I see as the two deepest philosophical questions and the most important. One is, what's real? How should we understand reality? And what should we choose to believe? And what matters morally? So what should we care about? What should we have compassion for? And I've got an obvious bias that already in that I'm trying to raise awareness of this very simple pluralistic way of thinking, a worldview called sentientism, which says that when it comes to what's real, we should use evidence and reason to always imperfectly build provisional and probabilistic beliefs about reality and just engage honestly with it to try and understand it. And when it comes to what matters, the clue is in the name, that we should have compassion for and moral consideration for any being that is sentient, so has the capacity to experience suffering or flourishing. But I'm talking to people in this series who agree and disagree with that philosophy. So it would be great to understand your personal philosophical journey and where you've got to now. But before we get onto that, for people who don't know you, how would you best introduce yourself and your work?
Sure. I think the largest part of my identity for the last couple of decades, I guess, has been I'm a professional tennis player. Yeah, that's been a large part of my life since I was pretty young. So I've been playing on the ATP World Tour for quite a long time now, and now only playing doubles. That's what I do with most of the hours of my day, but recently started a nonprofit called High Impact Athletes, which is a meta charity trying to funnel donations to the most cost-effective, impactful charities in the world in a few different cause areas: extreme poverty, climate change, and animal welfare, and most particularly farmed animal welfare, and trying to raise awareness of the difference in effectiveness and impact between charities, and trying to make people become more conscious of where they give their money and how they could possibly be doing more with it. Yeah, those, I guess, are the two biggest parts of my days these days. Tennis for most of the day, and then trying to get as many athletes and non-athletes on board with HIA as possible.
Yeah, great. And it'll be good to return back to that, because that's the final topic we cover, is how do we think about the future and how to make the world a better place. And High Impact Athletes is absolutely focused on that. But before we come to that part of the story, it would be good to start with the first of those two deep philosophical questions: what's real? And for many of my guests, that's a story about whether they grew up in a naturalistic or a atheistic or a sort of skeptic household and context, or whether they grew up in a more religious or a spiritual setting, and how their philosophy shifted over time, if it has. Yeah, you can wind the clock back as far as you like, but it'd be great to know your story on that sort of epistemological side of philosophy.
Yeah, so I guess my childhood was a real mix. I think probably the heaviest layer there was just pragmatism. I do come from a farming family. Both of my parents came from farming families. When you come from rural New Zealand, it's a real just roll your sleeves up and get the job done sort of attitude to life.
Yeah, not too much space for metaphysics.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so That's one aspect of it. Like, life and death are pretty close at hand. And when I was growing up, I took as much a part of life on the farm as I could. I did get involved with tennis pretty early on, which took me away quite a lot. But so there was that aspect of it. But then alongside that, actually, my father went through a real journey in his younger days, living in an ashram in India for a couple of years. And I think perhaps the pragmatism of a farm life might have pushed that down a little in his later years, but he was quite a spiritual guy and I think definitely still has flashes of that. And my mother, I think of as like a real hippie. She's a real earth child. She's, I'd say, very much a naturalist. She spends as much time in the garden as she possibly can, and her idea of relaxation is walking in the middle of nowhere with horses or animals for company. I think there was a really interesting mix of pragmatism and the sort of that sort of harshness of natural selection and being okay with death and dying and being the cause of death, paired with this love for nature and a recognition of something bigger or deeper. And yeah, so I went to some religious schools growing up, and by religious, I mean Christian. Honestly, I couldn't tell you which denomination of Christianity they were, but you know, I spent time in chapel. I had some religious education classes and I enjoyed it, but I never really bought in, so to speak. I always considered myself, if not atheist, then agnostic, strongly agnostic. And I think would have considered myself that way until I was in my early 20s. And then I was actually, when I was around 17, I moved to Slovakia for tennis on my own. And that was a real shift in so many different ways. I was living in a place where, nobody spoke English. I was still a very young man and I guess struggled to find meaning in life and struggled to get through the days. And that's when I discovered what I would call spirituality, which was the likes of Eckhart Tolle or those sort of writers that made some of the lessons of the East more accessible to English readers. And I think actually since then, it's been a real slow burn for me, becoming more and more enamored of philosophy and learning more and more about different ways to see the world. Studied some philosophy through university, and in my early 20s, 23, 24, came across some ideas of vegetarianism in a philosophy paper and some of the arguments for and against. And that really made me think about my relationship with animals and some of the discrepancies and dissonances there. However, I was a professional athlete, and a lot of those sort of very valid arguments just get squished by, yes, I'm an athlete, I need meat, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so fast forward to 3 or 4 years ago now, I had a real sort of life-shaking moment where I was in a sushi restaurant in Tokyo eating some delicious sushi with a couple of other tennis players. And one of them knew the restaurant back to front. He'd been going there for 10 years, knew the chefs. He was ordering rounds for us and he ordered a round of chopped whale. And there was just something that just didn't land, something that shocked me, and that it gave me the feeling that if I ate the sushi, then I would be a bad person. And I think that was a real pivotal moment in my life because it made me strongly consider what I believed to be real and what mattered. And from that evening, walking back to the hotel that evening, I started questioning my view of the world and my relationship with other sentient beings in it. And a week later, I went vegetarian and haven't eaten meat since. And that line between vegetarianism and veganism for me is a tough one. I eat vegan as much as I can. And then on tour, sometimes nutritionally, I need to get some vegetarian protein in. But anyway, that's a long rant. So I guess the short answer is I grew up with a whole mix of things, but yeah, pragmatism being the strongest factor there. And then in my mid to late 20s, I came to have a lot more respect for the whole hierarchy of animals and non-human animals, and started giving more respect to animals that I just had unthinkingly been treating poorly in the past.
Yeah. Thank you. And it's interesting that there's such a tight link for you between that sort of what's real and what's the nature of the universe and what are the ethical implications of that? Because for some people, they like to keep them quite separate. And there's a And some people will talk about the is-ought distinction, where there's facts about the world and then there's choices about what good and bad are. And I think that distinction is sometimes overblown. And that's partly the essence of these conversations, is linking that, thinking about what's real through to what matters. And going back to that sort of what's real epistemology side, it sounds like neither of your parents had a sort of formal religious context, but there was at least that sense of spirituality, transcendence, that connectedness with all things. And it feels like you picked that up as well. And through these conversations, it's really interesting because that feels like it's quite a common pattern for many people. Quite often they might move from a more established religion. They'll go through quite a, as you said, a sort of more convinced atheist agnostic phase, sometimes a bit of an angry atheist phase, but then that tends to soften, and it can soften again in the direction of recognizing the need for that interconnectedness and that awe and wonder and that transcendence. But there's still different flavors there, because some people do that in a way that still has some openness to mysticism and magic and maybe some other more amorphous type of deity, like the universe as a god, and is there some broader consciousness out there? And other people like me have those rich feelings of awe and wonder and interconnectedness of all things, and we are all stardust, with 100% more scientific, naturalistic worldview that sees no space for magic or mysticism or deities at all. Do you have a sense of whether your current way of thinking is one or the other, or open to either? Or
yes, I'm definitely more on the sort of logic science side. This is something that my wife and I have had hours and hours of debate, let's kindly call it, about, and will have for the rest of our lives, I think.
So neither of you looks like being a clear winner yet.
No, we both have these rocks that we land on at the end of every single debate, and we're both pretty happy landing on those rocks. So I don't know where it's going to go from there. But I envy the people who have a really strong sense of the possibility of mysticism or magical or supernatural things, or I don't know what to call it, but something other. But I'm like you in that I find so much awe and wonder in nature, and it doesn't need to be inexplicable for me to find awe and wonder in it. Like you put me next to the ocean or in a forest or in a jungle or whatever, and it's like experiencing magic for me.
I think it's I think it is the same emotional feeling that someone of a religious world you would have. I think the same stuff's going on in our heads, really, in the same response.
Yeah. And I think actually maybe the longer these conversations with my wife go, the more I feel a little bit of an opening in me for the idea of something energetic. Mm. And I don't think I can put a name on it or do it justice in an explanation, but I do feel like there might be something like karma, where it seems like I see evidence in my own life of if I put positive energy into the world, then in some way it comes back. And maybe that's completely explainable through, if I'm putting positive energy into the world, then I'm smiling a little more and someone's reacting to the smile, whatever it is. But I just think that, the give and take of energy, there might be something a little supernatural or extra about that.
Sounds like she's bringing you around. She's bringing you around.
Very slowly, maybe.
Well, and I think it's fascinating because I think there is a lot of commonality in that sense of awe and wonder. And to my mind, I find the reality such as it is more awesome than any of the fabrications people have made up. Because as I studied a bunch of different religions, it became more and more clear to me that they were basically fabricated by normally a guy a few hundred or a few thousand, or in some cases a few tens of years ago, in a particular context. They seem very much to be human creations, and I find much more, awe and wonder in reality. But it is interesting because I think there are many of those themes that you might pick up in Eastern thought or spiritual thinking around the connectedness of all things, around everything being energy, that I think you can see echoes of in modern physics. It doesn't mean that because there's space in quantum physics for weirdness that we link that to anything or draw any particular meaning from it. But in a sense, we are all connected, right? And, matter and energy are equivalent, and maybe the entire universe is computation. And so I think it's important we have a naturalistic worldview, not to let that become another sort of cold scientistic form of dogma where we say, well, we have all the answers, we've written them down, the story's over. Because to my mind, that sort of dogma is potentially as dangerous as supernatural dogma. As soon as you're 100% confident in anything, you stop thinking and stop looking and stop exploring. So that's one of the things that these conversations have helped me with, is to remind myself that even in this naturalistic scientific worldview, it has to have humility at its heart. You have to be open-minded. You have to hold your beliefs lightly. You have to be ready for new evidence. But at the same time, that doesn't mean I won't believe until the evidence is there. And there are so many, you know, there's an infinite number of things for which there's no evidence. So I'm not sure how you'd even know which to choose, but people do.
Yeah, you just reminded me a little of something that I hadn't thought about in a while, but I remember this was maybe 5 years ago. I was playing some tennis tournaments in France and I met this guy called Laurent Rochette, and he had become vegan about a year earlier and was really buzzing about it. And so I had a lot of great chats with him, and I wasn't vegetarian or vegan at the time. But one thing that he said that really stuck with me was since going vegan, he felt more of a kinship with animals, and he felt like he had I think his words were something like a better vibration in the world.
Yeah.
And at the time I thought, okay, this is a guy who's just really stoked with his decisions and good for him. But I didn't think there was anything more to it. However, a lot of people since I've gone vegetarian have asked me, what are the positives in it? Like, what do you find good about being vegan or vegetarian? And the thing that I land on more than anything physical, which for me actually it's been pretty neutral physically, which is great. There was no dip. Anyway, the thing that I always land on is I now feel like I'm living in my space in the world. I feel like I'm living in the world in the right way.
Yeah.
And the solidity and I think solidity is the best word I can use, that I feel in my decisions and in the way that I'm living in the world, that's a really positive thing for me. And yeah. And in terms of benefits or detriments, athletes are always looking for the things that can help them. That actually really feels like it has been a help for me to just live my life feeling a little more comfortable with how I'm living it.
It feels right to me again. And I don't think we need any mysticism for that. It's just a sense of fit and connectedness. And it does seem to me that there's this weird thing going on with humans, in that we are pretty amazing, right? You look at the capabilities, you look at the things we've done, good and bad, we're pretty distinctive. But at the same time, that sort of human exceptionalism or that anthropocentric way of thinking that we're separate and distinct and special can go so far that for some people, I think they almost feel like we're some sort of alien presence on the planet. We're so distinct and we're so separate. And I think that can lead to a sort of psychological dissonance about our place in the world. And it feels like that's one of the things that, you know, expanding your moral circle has helped you resolve. Because once we remind ourselves that the reason we care about other humans is because of their capacity to suffer, and then we think, and they're not the only beings that are capable of suffering. And when we think about our own evolutionary history and the fact that we're not at the pinnacle of some evolution that's developing something perfect, we're just another tiny little branch, and there's a whole tree out that's been developing for billions of years, and we're just one of the current ends of the branch. I think all of that maybe is part of that improving our level of comfort and sitting with the way the world is and our place in it, right? Rather than thinking we're some sort of unique, distinctive. And I think you can get to that human exceptionalism in at least a couple of ways, right? That's a very strong theme in a lot of religious thinking. Humans are made in the image of God. Humans have souls, animals don't. We are given dominion over this planet, which enables us to basically do what the hell we like. So that's the sort of one religious way of thinking about humans as being unique and special and distinctive and so on. But you can get to that path in a sort of naturalistic scientific worldview as well, and say the dolphins haven't built skyscrapers, therefore we're better than they are, and we're clearly more intelligent, so we deserve more moral consideration. So I think you can get to that human exceptionalism both through a naturalistic scientific way of thinking and a supernatural one. And I think they're both flawed. So it's really interesting that you feel that psychological benefit of having a broader moral scope.
Right. There's a bit of a trap that you can fall into if you try and get to human exceptionalism through scientific scientific route is the best way to explain it. Who is to say that intelligence is the thing that we should be measuring by? I could be absolutely fudging facts here, but I remember reading something about orcas, or it might have been all whales, having an area of the brain that humans didn't have, and scientists were trying to puzzle out what it was for, and thought maybe it was an area that forge stronger family ties or something like that. And we just have no idea. We have no idea the depth or breadth of experience that other sentient beings can experience. And okay, intelligence seems like a pretty useful yardstick to use, but it's not the only yardstick. And that's something that I never thought about until I recognized my own dissonance. And it goes back to the whale story, recognizing the dissonance and thinking that I would be an asshole if I was going to eat a whale, but the tuna and salmon and even the beef tar sushi that I had before was totally fine.
Yeah.
And
it's interesting I think, what that trigger was.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really is. I think I would consider myself a sentientist now because it is what I fall back on with my decisions in the world and how I try to live my life is I try to give respect to all sentient beings. If they can suffer, then try not to cause them suffering. And if you do that, it doesn't matter if it's a whale suffering or a sheep suffering or a fish suffering, it's still suffering. And yeah, that was a bit of a rant as well, but I do think that using intelligence as the yardstick has some flaws in itself. Yeah.
And we wouldn't use intelligence for assessing human moral worth, would we? Right. And I think that's quite often an interesting test when we think about the ethics we use to apply to non-human animals. It's just as a thought experiment. It doesn't mean you have to think humans and all other non-human animals are the same. But if you just think they all have some moral worth, it's a really interesting thought experiment to take our animal ethics and apply that to human animals and see if it works. And quite often you'll get to quite a horrific place that will make you think, yeah, you know, maybe there's a problem there. And
I've got a question for you. I'd love your insight on this. So let's say that at some point artificial intelligence gets to a stage where it is considered sentient. Do you think that an AI's capacity to suffer is worth something morally?
Yes.
Interesting. I still don't know where I sit on this one.
Now, where I'm agnostic is whether that's possible. I think it is. How long it might take, who knows? But in principle, for me, the capacity to suffer, that sentience is what matters. And that matters regardless of species, but it also matters regardless of substrate. And so this is another area where sentientism is deliberately really broad, right? So there are lots of different views within sentientism about what sentience really is and its nature and even how broadly spread it is. There are sentientists who think that consciousness is some sort of distinct thing from physical reality. Others like me just think it's a class of information processing. There are some who think it will never be artificially generated, that there's something about biology that is required to generate sentience. And again, I don't agree with that. I think it's just a class of information processing. So in principle, I don't see why we couldn't create artificial sentience either. So it's a very broad worldview and loads of people disagree with each other on almost everything. But yeah, I would say if we've got a decent, reasonable evidence that any entity, artificial, alien, biological, has that capacity to have subjective experiences that can be good or bad, yeah, they warrant moral consideration. That's a long answer, but yeah, it's the short answer.
Would that have to be programmed in? Would the capacity to suffer have to be programmed in?
Well, I think it would either have to be programmed in or it would have to develop in some sort of pseudo-evolutionary process. So again, many sentientists would disagree, but my current hypothesis about what sentience is that it's a class of information processing that's involved in the reasonably advanced modeling of the self as an entity of other entities and the environment as a whole that includes some sense of valence, some sense of positive but negative as a motivator. And the reason that developed in biological entities, animals, probably pre or during the Cambrian, was because it's evolutionarily useful to be able to model yourself to take decisions that mean you can move towards good stuff and move away from bad stuff. That's how I think sentience came to be in animals, including us. And obviously it's developed in many different ways. And we have a version that feels pretty rich to us. I'm experiencing it moment to moment. So I don't think it's something that happens accidentally. I think there was an evolutionary drive for why animals and human animals experience sentience now. So I think you'd need something similar for an artificial version. So either you'd need to deliberately design that in, or you'd have to have some, or have the artificial intelligence design it in, because it won't be too long before artificial intelligence is better at designing the next generation than we are. I think we're pretty close already. Or there would be some evolutionary part of the code development process, of which there are many ideas and experiments out there already, that would have meant there's some rationale for that subjective third person valenced experience to exist. So yeah, it's a fascinating topic, and it's, I find it intellectually interesting just because I love my sci-fi and artificial intelligence, and these things are moving so quickly, outlandish ideas might become relevant more quickly than people think. Others, probably most sentientists, think it's a bit of a distraction because we should be worried about the trillions of very obviously sentient beings, including the one barking behind me, who what's that, Luna? Who are suffering and definitely exist today, rather than worrying about whether artificial intelligences might potentially exist in the future.
What is it?
Yeah, but so that's a really long answer. But I think in concept it's possible, because I think it's just a class of information processing. And if we think there's a decent confidence they have sentience, then yes, we should care about them morally. And there's some really interesting thinking already going on about the potential for, in the effective altruism community, you would have heard of existential risk and catastrophic risk, but there's another class of risk of suffering risks, where there's a risk accidentally, we create vast swathes of catastrophic suffering, potentially in artificial entities that we do unwittingly. Yeah, it's a bit of a weird, edgy topic, but an interesting one.
Yeah, I feel well out of my depth there, but I think it's going to become more and more salient as we go forward.
I think it will. Who knows how that field would develop, but it's happening quickly. And we've spanned both of those two central questions really richly already, because you've already told me the story really on the sort of what matters side of things. And I think I'd summarize it really as saying, if I ask you what matters morally, it is really suffering and flourishing. It's that capacity for experience, that sentience that matters to you. And you also talked about how you've gone through that journey of, like most people, starting out just assuming humans matter morally, but then thinking more about it, and then having that moment in the sushi house where it clicked and you recognize it's not just humans that suffer too. And I think I very much share that perspective. Some people are hesitant about moving away from a supernatural or a religious worldview because they're worried they'll lose their moral foundations. But for me, just as with that sense of awe and wonder and connectedness, you can ground your morality in a naturalistic scientific understanding of what sentient beings are and what sentience is as a process, as a characteristic, as a phenomenon. And that matters morally, almost regardless of what the basis of the sentience is. So yeah, I think we probably line up quite neatly there on that sort of link between a naturalistic way of thinking about what reality is and then grounding a moral system based on the capacity to suffer and a choice to care about the perspectives of others.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. It's very unoriginal, but I think the way Peter Singer describes it in Animal Liberation, his idea around how to act in the world to either eliminate or cause very little suffering with your actions, that resonated very deeply with me, and it's something that I try to live by going forward. And I think one thing that I just want to mention is, I think it's incredibly easy for everyone, myself included, to just not think about what actions they're taking in the world. Mm-hmm. For 20-something years, I didn't think about why I was eating meat or I knew what it took to get from animal to on my table. That was part of what I grew up with. I hunted in my childhood, so I wasn't separated from that process, but it was what was done in my community, in my culture. And yeah, I think it took a sort of shocking moment for me. And it was only shocking because in New Zealand, we love whale watching and they're sacred animals. If I'd grown up in Japan, that wouldn't have been a shocking moment at all. But I wonder how we can create more of these sort of culturally shocking moments to make more people understand that the way that they've always done things might not be the best way to do things. And it's worth looking deeper. That was the thing that catalyzed my whole moral or I guess more of a behavioral shift in me, because I think the morals were somewhere there, just hidden under layers of culture and tradition. And yeah, I just wonder how we can create more of those shocking moments in a way that's not confrontational or raises hackles. I don't know what the answer is there, but I think it could be pretty crucial.
Yeah, I like the way you put that, because in a way that's, you know, the final section of the conversation really is in that context, thinking about the future. And again, a theme that runs really strongly through these conversations is that with most of the people I've talked to, not all, but most of the people I've talked to, we do seem to share this sense that the things we're talking about here are almost tautologically true. It's the best way to understand the universe is to engage with it honestly and gather evidence and reason and recognize and be skeptical of your own rationality and have humility in that understanding. Like, that's the essence of a naturalistic worldview. What, you know, anything else surely has to be arbitrary and fabricated. And so it almost feels locked in and solid and obvious. But most people on the planet disagree in a sense, because they are brought up in a context where essentially they're taught that it's okay to believe things without evidence, right? Whether that be a formal supernatural view or something else, mystical or whatever it is. And so that's one side of the challenge. The other side of the challenge, when we're thinking about morality and what matters morally, again, is similar, because I think you're right. That sort of moral basis is in nearly everyone already, right? We just, again, because of the way we've evolved and because of aspects of our culture, supernatural or otherwise, there's a rich vein of compassionate thinking in most of the, you know, most people's way of thinking, unless they're psychopath. And if you ask most people, or you give them a direct choice, would you needlessly want to cause suffering? They'll say, no, of course not. Do you think I'm some sort of monster? But again, given the patterns of indoctrination and social norms and culture and tradition, we are, you know, led to believe and taught relentlessly that certain things that do needlessly cause harm are normal, natural, necessary, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it is. It's almost like the logical argument is one thing, right? But the real blocker feels like it's much more about human psychology and cognitive dissonance and social norms and traditions and patterns of behavior that have real rich resonance and controlling impact on people's lives. So that's almost the frustration that I think people on both sides of that story feel is, this is so obviously true. Why won't people just agree with me? And we know that's just not how most people's minds work. So in that context, that's why I like to ask, I guess, this question about what could the future look like. So one, we can take a utopian view and say, look, if we imagine magically we could persuade 7.8 billion people to take a naturalistic worldview and have a much broader compassion for all sentient beings, what could that future look like in a sort of sci-fi world? But more pragmatically, how can we move towards that? And you've touched on that challenge already about, you know, the logical argument just isn't sufficient. What are the ways of giving people those moments where they can change? So I'd love to know your thoughts on that general topic, but it would also be great to, in the time we've got left, talk a little bit more about effective altruism, your involvement in that, and what you're doing with high impact athletes as well, because that's in a very direct way trying to help people take better Sure. decisions to make the world a better place.
Yeah, I think just one thing I wanted to mention is since I went vegetarian, a lot of tennis players have cornered me and asked me, what are your experiences? Why did you do it? And I've had great conversations with a lot of people, and a lot of people have agreed with the reasons why I went vegetarian and yet don't change anything in their behaviors. And that's one thing that I find incredibly frustrating, because it's okay, so we agree on all the reasons and those were the reasons why I changed my behavior, but there's still something not clicking there. And that's why I was speaking about that shocking moment, that jarring moment that sort of almost shakes people and makes them realize, oh, those reasons actually matter. Like they have meaning in my life. But in terms of the future, this is still something I don't feel I have a really strong opinion about, because on one hand, I would love for the world to be plant-based, and I don't know enough about the science or the economic structure or the even just the logistical structure of having a plant-based world without animals and manure and the role that they play in plant farming. So I wonder if the utopian image of the world in the future is where all farming is regenerative, which incorporates animals to an extent, but they live as good a life as they can possibly live, so that they're sort of net experiencing flourishing during their lives. And death, you know, something that Peter Singer talks about is death might actually ethically be neutral if the life itself is net positive. I don't actually know where I sit on that, but the sort of realistic utopian world that I see is one where all farming that is done regeneratively, and meat is a real luxury one-off item for when an animal has already lived a great life. And I don't know if that's as scalable as it needs to be to feed 7.8 billion people or however many people it's going to be in 50 years when, you know, an idea like that might be able to come to fruition. But that's something that I'd love to see growing as a movement.
And I think
particularly, and sorry, I think, just to finish that thought, particularly yeah, yeah. in the country where we can, where there's no excuse, where we have the riches and the options and the opportunity to do that. And it would actually be net positive for everyone involved. Like that feels like such a no-brainer to me. It's going to take some growing changes, some pains and a shift. Like when you shift anything, you experience some difficulties. But yeah, in the wealthier countries, I would love to see that happening sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Agree. And my simple view is that I think we've got common cause, even with many people who consume animal products around intensive industrial factory farming. There's some things that almost everybody agrees, even while they buy from it, we should transition and get rid of. I mean, I do take a fairly purist line in that ultimately taking the perspective of the sentient being, I don't see that there's any form of farming or fishing that ultimately we should want to see continue, partly because I think actually if we shift our emphasis from the subsidies to keep these things going and we think about just transitions and we think about new models of farming and we think about new models of agriculture, we can find solutions to many of those problems as well. And in trite terms, I think if we do need manure from animals for regenerative farming, it's probably best not to kill them because then they'll produce more manure. So if we need some role. And the other thing that shocked me as I learned more about this was just the sheer inefficiency of animal agriculture. So I think it's our world in data stats are amazing, right? Animal agriculture takes up something like 77% of all agricultural land, but produces, I think it's 18% of the calories and something like 30% of the protein. And it's breathtaking. So in terms of feeding the world and just environmental impact, we could, you know, if we did drive that just transition from animal to plant-based, you could free up 2/3 of all agricultural land. That's trillions of acres for more sustainable purposes and produce even more food and nutrients we have now. So I do think there's actually a route to a more purist path, but I think that the shared priority should, as you say, be the industrial factory farmed, you know, that there's no excuse. And addressing those things is just a clear win-win for the environment, for us and for non-human animals too.
Yeah. I completely agree. And my heart and my soul thinks that that's the way it should be. I'd like to learn more about the realities of scaling. And like one thing that, again, I'm very unlearned on, but one of the main alternatives to animal fertilization is a petrol-based fertilizer, and that obviously has pretty terrible implications going forward.
Exactly. So we need more. Yeah. I think you're right. We need more work on these things, and we also need to transition with compassion for the many millions of people whose lives are involved in these industries as well. We can't just steamroller across them. We've got to help them find ways of living a less harmful life. Yeah, much to do. So I know you've got to run in a minute. Do you want to just finish off with a sort of quick overview of what you're trying to do with high impact athletes and how that fits into the EA world more broadly?
Sure. It's inspired by effective altruism and I guess fits more securely into the effective giving space. So I think I mentioned earlier that we cover three main cause areas: extreme poverty, climate change, and animal welfare. And we're just trying to raise awareness about the fact that some charities can be 10, 100, even 1,000 times more impactful than others. There are some incredible organizations, research organizations, that have done years and years of legwork, really rigorous evidence-based legwork, to find out what the most effective charities are in each of those spaces. And HIA is trying to get as many athletes on board to first donate, to have skin in the game, to either pledge a percentage of their income or to donate when it feels right to these highly effective charities, and then trumpet it to their audiences and followings to try and create a groundswell of giving in the most effective places. I think this is a much narrower point than the sentientism movement. I think the potential of a movement like sentientism could end up having a huge amount more impact, but as a way for each individual to be able to move the needle and actually in a meaningful way, because these organizations are so effective at what they do with each dollar. Yeah, donating to these organizations is a great way to make a tangible impact. So
yeah,
trying to grow as quickly as I can and gather as much momentum as I can with it, and hopefully create a bit of a norm in the athlete world of pledging a percentage of income to highly effective places.
Brilliant. I mean, and to your point, sentientism as an idea feels like quite a background thing. It's really about values and ideas rather than what you're doing, which is having direct impact. And for me, that's one of the most inspiring things. Some people can be hesitant about effective altruism because it feels quite demanding and quite oppressive as an obligation to do good in the world, which is fair. We need to face up to that. But there's an inspiring side to this as well, because some of these organizations and ideas out there around the world are doing so much good for so little money. There's an amazing opportunity for people to make a contribution, and that's a brilliant opportunity. Yeah. Yeah. So thank you for the leadership role you're playing, because as you say, it's not just, you know, about the money you've pledged to give and your athletes are pledging to give. It's also given your profile, you know, an enormous positive influence on the values of the world. And given, you know, the effect of altruism and the charities you're thinking about are, you know, committed to using evidence and reason to work out how to do good in the world. And because explicitly they're not just human causes either. I do consider non-human farmed animals too. Yeah, it's you know, very in line with sentientist principles as well. So it's an inspiring story. Thank you. And I know you've got to run. So what's the best way of people following you, keeping up with your tennis career, your high impact athletes work as well? I can include links in the show notes, of course, so don't worry too much, but where would you point people?
Cool. Yeah. So High Impact Athletes can be found all over the socials. Just search for High Impact Athletes. Our website is a great source of information if you're interested in making a donation. That's highimpactathletes.org. You can check out the athletes who have already joined. We've got some real heavyweights there already, which is fantastic. And me, you can search for Marcus Daniel. I am on the socials. I'm pretty useless, I'm afraid, with keeping things updated. But yeah, I'm there. And if anyone's interested in being part of High Impact Athletes, you don't need to be an athlete. All we care about is that the dollars get to these organizations that do amazing things with them. A dollar means the same if it comes from LeBron James or from Joe Bloggs. So yeah, if you're interested in being involved, please do reach out. And yeah, I really enjoyed this chat. It's outside of the conversations with my wife in the tennis world. I don't often get to dive into these philosophical quagmires. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
It's a real pleasure. It's been an honor to talk to you. And hopefully I've given you some more ammo to push back on your partner with the mysticism and the woo and the transcendence.
I'll let you know how it goes.
Yeah, good luck. Good luck. It's been a real pleasure, Marcus. Thank you. It's an inspiration. Take care.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?